is firmly within the bounds of the law, as well as something that happens routinely in this courthouse and courthouses across the country. It is not a do-over or a delay tactic. I am charged with seeking true justice for the victim of this cold-blooded murder. Through the grand jury and the presentation of evidence from the ongoing investigation, we have elected to upgrade the charges in the pursuit of justice. In my peripheral vision, I saw Berg glance my way as she threw my own words back at me. I did not give her the satisfaction of a look back. Your Honor, the case against the defendant is strong and getting stronger as the investigation of this crime continues. That's what the defendant knows. That is what he is trying to subvert. A search for truth with all the evidence on the table. It is his hope that by hurrying into trial, he can stop the mounting evidence from crushing him. That won't happen, because the truth is inevitable. Thank you. The judge paused before speaking, possibly waiting to see whether I would stand to object or respond to Berg. She even swiveled her chair back toward me as if expecting it. But I held my ground. I had made my points, and there was no need to restate them. "This is a novel situation," Warfield began. "It has been my experience as a judge and as a defense attorney in a prior life that it is the defendant who most often seeks delays, seemingly in an effort to put off the inevitable, but not in this case. And so, the arguments today give me pause. Mr. Haller clearly wants this behind him, no matter the outcome. He also wants to be free to build his case." The judge swiveled toward Berg. "On the other hand, the state gets only one shot at this," she said. "There are no do-overs, and therefore time to prepare is key. There are new charges in the case, and the state bears the responsibility of being able to support those charges to a level far above the probable cause threshold found by the grand jury. The burden of proof, proving guilt beyond a reasonable doubt, is just as heavy as the burden carried by the defense." The judge straightened her seat and leaned forward, clasping her hands together. "The court is inclined in these matters to split the baby, and I will let the defense choose how that split is made. Mr. Haller, you decide. I will continue your bail with all the existing restrictions, but you will waive your right to a speedy trial. Or I will revoke bail, but refuse to change the case calendar, leaving the start of trial on this matter set for the 18th of February. How do you wish to proceed?" Before I could stand and respond, Berg did. "Your Honor," she said urgently, "may I be heard?" "No, Ms. Berg," the judge said. "The court has heard all it needs to hear. Mr. Haller, will you make a choice, or would you like me to allow Ms. Berg to choose?" I stood slowly. "A moment, Your Honor?" I asked. "Make it fast, Mr. Haller," Warfield said. "I am in an uncomfortable position that I will not hold for long." I turned toward the railing behind the defense table and looked at my daughter. I signaled her closer, and she slid forward on her seat, putting her hands on top of the rail. I leaned down and put my hands on top of hers. "Haley, I want this over with," I whispered. "I didn't do this, and I think I can prove it. I want to go in February. You going to be okay with that?" "Dad, it was so hard when they had you in jail before," she whispered back. "Are you sure?" "It's like what you and your mother and I talked about. I'm free right now, but inside I feel like I'm still locked up as long as this is hanging over me. I need it to be over."
"I know, but I worry."
From behind me, I heard the judge. "Mr. Haller," she said, "we are waiting." I kept my eyes on my daughter. "It's going to be all right," I said. I quickly leaned over the rail and kissed her on the forehead. I then glanced at Kendall and nodded. I could tell by the look of surprise on her face that she expected more. She expected to be consulted. That I had sought my daughter's approval on this choice rather than hers might doom our relationship. But I did what I felt I had to do. I turned back to the judge and announced my decision. "Your Honor, I suspend myself to the court at this time," I said, "and I will be ready to defend myself on the charges on February 18th as scheduled. I am innocent, Judge, and the faster I can get to a jury to prove it, the better." The judge nodded, seemingly not surprised, but concerned by my decision. "Very well, Mr. Holler," she said. She made it official with rulings from the bench, but not without a final objection from the prosecution. "Your Honor," Berg said, "the people ask that your ruling on the trial date be stayed while under review by the Second District Court of Appeal." Warfield looked at her for a long moment before replying. It is always a risky move to tell a judge you are appealing a ruling from the bench when you still have a whole trial before the same judge ahead of you. Judges are supposed to be impartial, but when you announce you were going to a higher court to complain that your lower court judge was in error, well, there are ways for that jurist to even the score down the line. A perfect example is what Judge Hagen did to me at my first appearance on this case. I had reversed him twice on appeal. He paid me back by slapping me with a $5 million bail. He all but winked and smiled at me when he did it. Berg was walking a similar line with Warfield now, and it looked like the judge was giving her a few seconds to reconsider. But Berg waited her out. "Miss Berg, I'll now give you a choice," Warfield finally said. "I won't stay the ruling on the 686 motion without staying the ruling on Mr. Holler's bail revocation. So if you want to stay while you appeal, then Mr. Holler remains free under the current bail arrangement until you get a ruling from the appellate court." The two women locked eyes for a tense 5 seconds before the prosecutor responded. "Thank you, Your Honor," Berg said coldly. "The people withdraw the request for a stay." "Very well," Warfield responded with just as much ice. "Then I think we are adjourned here." As the judge stood up, the deputies in the room moved toward me. I was going back to Twin Towers. Chapter 33. Friday, January 24th. I was placed back in K-10, the high-power module at Twin Towers, where they housed inmates on keep-away status. The only problem I had with this was that I wanted to be kept away from the jailers more than from the jailed. The investigation that had followed the eavesdropping scandal had put the mark on me, and I knew the potential that the jailed deputies would get back at me physically had increased exponentially. Bishop was long gone, and I needed new protection. In a way, I held auditions. I spoke to a handful of men in the module the morning after my arrival, attempting to learn whom I might be able to trust, who might have greater enmity for the hacks than I did. I settled on a guy named Carew, who was physically impressive and being held on a murder charge. I didn't know the details of the case and didn't ask for them. But I learned that he had private counsel, and I knew that a murder defense cost serious money. I offered him $400 a week to watch my back and settled the negotiation at $500, delivered weekly to his attorney. The days in the jail fell into the same routine as the earlier stint, with my team coming into conference most afternoons at 3. It seemed that our nets had already been cast, and we were in the stage where we were looking through the catch and devising our strategy. My energy and outlook remained high. I was confident in the case. I just wanted to get to it. The only break from the routine came 3 days after my rearrest, when I was taken to the visitor center and sat down in front of my first ex-wife, Maggie McPherson. Her coming to see me embarrassed me and made my heart swell at once. "Is anything wrong?" I said. "Is Haley all right?" "Everything's fine out here," she said. I just wanted to see you. How are you, Mickey? I was ashamed of my situation and my jailhouse blues. I could imagine how I must appear to her, especially after her taking exception to the way I had looked outside jail. All things considered, I'm okay, I said. The trial's soon, and this will all be over. Are you ready? She asked. More than ready. I think we're going to win this thing. Good. I don't want our daughter to lose her father. She won't. That's what keeps me going. Maggie nodded and said nothing more on it. I read the reason for her visit as her checking on my health and state of mind. It means a lot to me that you came here, I said. Of course, she said. And if you need anything, call me. Collect. I will. Thanks. The visit only lasted 15 minutes, but I came away from it feeling stronger. With family, as splintered as it was, behind me, I felt like I couldn't lose. Chapter 34. Wednesday, February 5th. The silk suit felt good against my skin. It eased the itch from the prison rash I had developed over most of my body. I sat quietly next to Jennifer Aronson at the defense table and savored the moment of pseudo-freedom and relief. I had been taken to court for a hearing requested by the prosecution, which was seeking sanctions for alleged foul play on the part of the defense. But no matter what the cause, I was happy to be pulled out of Twin Towers for any reason, for any amount of time. Over the years, I'd had many incarcerated clients who exhibited and complained about prison rash. Visits to the jail clinic didn't cure it or explain it. Its origin was unknown. It had been suggested that the industrial detergent used on jail bedding and laundry caused it, or that there was something in the material used in the thin mattresses in cells. Others said it was an allergic reaction to confinement. Still others called it the manifestation of guilt. All I knew was that I didn't get it the first time around at Twin Towers, and then I got it bad the second. The difference was that, in between stays, I had been the root cause of another damaging internal investigation of the jail system. This made me think that the jail deputies were behind it, that the rash that kept me itching and awake at night was a form of payback. They had spiked my food, or my laundry, or my cell in some way. I kept this belief to myself to avoid being considered paranoid. My physical decline and weight loss was continuing, and I wanted no one to add concerns about mental acuity to the question of whether I could adequately defend myself. Maybe it was the suit, or maybe it was the courtroom. All I knew was that my preoccupation with the malady went away as soon as I left the jail and was put on the bus. On the way over, the bus had passed two painted murals depicting Kobe Bryant. The famed Lakers basketball star had been killed with his daughter and others in a helicopter crash only 10 days earlier, and already the street memorials were up in solemn testimony to his transcending mastery of his sport to reach iconic status in a city where the climb to that level was already so crowded. I heard the soft thud of the courtroom door closing and turned to see that Kendall Roberts had entered. She gave a secretive wave as she came down the center aisle. I smiled. She moved down the first row and sat directly behind the defense table. Hey, Mickey. Kendall, you didn't have to come all the way down. This probably is going to be a pretty quick hearing. It's still better than the 15 minutes they give you at the jail. Well, thanks. Also, I wanted to... She stopped when she saw Chan, the courtroom deputy, moving toward us to order me to stop communicating with people in the gallery. I held my hand up to signal that I was halting the violation. I turned forward and leaned toward Jennifer. Do you mind telling Kendall that I'll call her later when I can get to the phone in the module? Not at all. Jennifer got up to whisper to Kendall, and I went back to staring straight ahead and feeling the tension leak out of my muscles and spine. You never stopped looking over your shoulder in Twin Towers. I savored these moments when I didn't have to worry. Jennifer returned to her seat. I finally came out of my reverie and got to work. So, I said, what's the update on Aparicio? I'd gotten the word during a team meeting Monday that the Indians had finally located him when they followed Jeannie Farino to a rendezvous at a hotel in Beverly Hills. They dropped her and stayed with Aparicio, tailing him to a house in Brentwood that was held in an impenetrable blind trust. Same, Jennifer said. They're ready to go with the subpoena when you give the word. Okay, let's wait till next week. But if it looks like he might be getting ready to split town, we need to serve him. He can't get away. We know, but I'll remind Cisco. We also serve the girlfriend then and his two other associates holding shares in BioGreen, and all of it on camera, so we can show the judge if they don't show up. Got it. I glanced over at the prosecution table. Berg was by herself today. No bow tie backup. She was looking at a handwritten document, and I guessed that she was rehearsing her argument. She sensed my gaze. Hypocrite, she said. Excuse me? I said.
You heard me. You talk about tilting the board all the time, and the prosecution not playing fair, and then you pull a stunt like this.
Like what?
I'm sure you know what this is about. Like I said, and you heard, you're a hypocrite, Holler, and a murderer.
I looked at her for a long moment, and I could see it in her eyes. She was a true believer. She had me down as a killer. It's one thing when the cops think it. Most of them can't see the difference between a defense lawyer and a defendant. But in the world of trial lawyers, I had for the most part encountered respect from both sides of the aisle. That Berg believed I was capable of putting a man in a trunk and shooting him 3 times was a reminder of what I was facing at the trial ahead, a true believer who wanted to put me away forever. You're so wrong, I said. You're so blinded by the lies you've been told by save it for the jury, Holler, she said. The verbal confrontation ended with Deputy Chan announcing that court was coming to order. Judge Warfield stepped through the door at the back of the courtroom and took the bench. She quickly got down to business on California versus Holler and invited Berg to explain her request for sanctions against the defense. The prosecutor took the document she had been studying to the lectern with her.
Your Honor, the defense in this case has repeatedly accused the people of playing unfair with discovery, and yet it is the defense that has engaged in deception all along,
Berg began.
Ms. Berg, the judge cut in, I don't need the preamble. Get to the point. If there is a discovery violation, please get to it.
Yes, Your Honor. On Monday, the latest witness lists were due from each side, and to our surprise, the defense actually put new names on their witness list. One name that stood out to us was Rosemarie Dietrich, whom the defense listed as the landlord of the victim in this case, Sam Scales.
Was this a witness the prosecution was not familiar with?
No, Your Honor, we were not familiar with her. I dispatched investigators to locate and talk to her, and we learned that the reason she was not known to us is that Sam Scales used a false identity when he rented an apartment from her.
I'm not seeing the problem here as far as the defense goes, Miss Berg.
Your Honor, the problem is in what Rosemarie Dietrich told us. She said that Mr. Holler and two of his investigators spoke with her 3 weeks ago about Sam Scales, who was using the name Walter Lennon when he rented the apartment. Additionally, she allowed Mr. Holler and his crew to look through the victim's belongings, which were stored in the garage of the property. Unaware that Mr. Scales had been murdered in October, Dietrich and her husband boxed his belongings when he seemed to disappear without paying rent for December. They stored his property in the garage.
This is all very interesting, but where is the infraction the people are seeking sanctions for?
Judge, the point is that the defense had access to several boxes of belongings, including documents and mail, and yet, 3 weeks later, nothing has come to the people in discovery. They didn't put Rosemarie Dietrich's name on their witness list until this week in order to ensure that when the prosecution got to Ms. Dietrich, it would have no access to the property. Why would that be, Ms. Berg? Because they were turned over to the Salvation Army after the defendant and his crew visited Ms. Dietrich. It is quite obvious that the defense had a strategy to keep whatever information was in the victim's belongings from the people, Your Honor. That is a lot of supposition. Do you have anything that backs that up? We have a sworn statement from Rosemarie Dietrich that states unequivocally that she was told by the defendant that she could donate the property. Then let me take a look at that. Berg dropped off a copy of the statement with me after handing one to the clerk for the judge. There was silence for a minute or so as Jennifer and I huddled together to read the witness statement at the same time as the judge. "Okay, the court has read the document," Warfield said. "I'd like to hear from Mr. Haller on this matter next." I got up and went to the lectern as Berg abandoned it. I decided on the bus ride over to go full-on sarcastic with my response, as opposed to full-on outraged. "Good morning, Judge," I said good-naturedly. "I would like to begin by saying that normally I would welcome any opportunity to leave the spare accommodations afforded me at the Twin Towers Correctional Facility, courtesy of Ms. Berg, to be in court. But this time, I am baffled by the reason I'm here and the logic of her argument. It seems to me, Your Honor, that she should be seeking sanctions against her own team of investigators, not the defense." "Mr. Haller," Warfield said in a tired tone, "as I said to Ms. Berg, let's stay on point. Please respond directly to the discovery issue that the prosecution has raised." "Thank you, Judge. My response is to say there has been no discovery violation. I have no documents to turn over, and I've hidden nothing from the prosecution. Yes, we went to the address in question and looked through the contents of the boxes stored there. I took nothing from those boxes, and I guarantee that Ms. Berg's investigators asked Rosemarie Dietrich what we took. Unhappy with the response they got to that question, Ms. Berg chose not to include the answer in this piece of paper she claims is a statement of fact. It's got some facts listed here, Judge, but not all of them." "Judge," Berg said, rising from her seat. "Your Honor, I'm not finished," I said quickly. "Ms. Berg, you had your turn," Warfield said. "Let counsel finish, and then you will get a chance to respond." Berg sat back down and started writing furiously on her legal pad. "In closing, Your Honor," I said, "there is no subterfuge here. The court recalls that 3 weeks ago, in a teleconference hearing that Ms. Berg was party to, I asked permission to leave the county and state. I assume the court reporter has a record of that hearing, and it will reveal that the prosecution asked specifically whom I was going to see at High Desert State Prison in Nevada, and I said I was going to visit the former cellmate of the victim in this case. If Ms. Berg, or any of the many investigators at her disposal, had bothered to follow up and talk to that man in Nevada, they would have gotten the same address and alias for Sam Scales that I got, and in fact, could have beaten me to the location we're talking about here. Your Honor, again, I say that this is nothing but sour grapes. The discovery obligations of the defense require that I turn over to Ms. Berg a witness list and copies of anything I intend to offer into evidence. I have done that. I am not required to share with Ms. Berg my interviews, observations, or other work product. She knows that. But since day one, the prosecution's investigation has been lazy, sloppy, and shoddy. I am confident that I will prove that at trial. But the sad thing is, there shouldn't be a trial. The prosecution has..." "Okay, let me stop you right there, Mr. Haller," the judge said. "I believe you have more than made your point. You can return to your seat now." "Thank you, Your Honor," I said. Usually, when a judge tells you to sit down, it means that all that needs to be said has been said and a decision has been made. The judge swiveled in her chair and focused on Berg. "Ms. Berg, do you recall the teleconference referred to by counsel?" she asked. Yes, Your Honor,
Berg said. There was no emotion in her tone. She had taken the same cue I had when Warfield told me to sit down.
It appears to me that the state had every opportunity to follow and find this location and the victim's belongings, Warfield said. The court tends to agree with Mr. Haller that this is about work product and a missed opportunity, not about any gamesmanship on the part of the defense. Certainly nothing I would consider a violation of discovery.
Berg stood, but did not move to the lectern, a sign that her protest was going to be half-hearted, no matter what she had scribbled on her legal pad.
He waited 3 weeks to put her on the witness list, she said. He was hiding her importance. There should have been a written report about the interview and the search of the property. That is exactly what the spirit and intention of discovery is.
I started to rise to object, but the judge made a signal with her hand, gesturing me back into my chair.
Ms. Berg,
the judge intoned, the first note of annoyance in her voice.
If you are suggesting that Mr. Haller is under an obligation to document his investigation with reports of his moves and interviews, just like a law enforcement agency, and then immediately decide whether he will call Miss Dietrich as a witness, then you must take me for a fool.
No, Your Honor, Berg said quickly. Not at all.
Very well, then. We're done here. The motion for sanctions is denied.
The judge looked over at the calendar that hung on the wall over the clerk's corral.
We are 13 days from jury selection, she said. I'm setting a hearing for next Thursday at 10 a.m. for final motions. I want to handle everything on that day. That means get your paperwork in with enough time for the court to consider it. I want no surprises. I will see you all then.
The judge adjourned court, and I felt the dread of incarceration return before Deputy Chan and his cohorts could even get to me. Chapter 35. Upon my second arrest, I was placed back in a single-bed cell at Twin Towers. This time, I had even graduated to the outside wall of the jail, which gave me a window, only 4 inches wide and escape-proof. But it had a partial view of the criminal courts building, just a few blocks away as the crow flies. It was enough of a view for me to want to stay in the cell with my eyes on the prize, rather than congregate in the day room with the other keepaways. And this, even though I had replaced Bishop with Carew. So I was feeling safe and secure in the module. The problem was that there were no such protections on the jail buses that moved hundreds of inmates to and from court each day. Whom you rode with and whom you were chained to was mostly a matter of chance, or so it appeared. No matter what measure I took to protect myself in custody, I was always going to be most vulnerable on the bus. I knew this for a fact because I'd had clients attacked on the buses, and I had seen fights break out and attacks staged while riding them myself. After the hearing on the prosecution's motion for sanctions, I waited 2 hours in the courthouse jail before being shuttled onto a bus back to the towers. I was cuffed fourth on a chain, behind 3 other men, and moved onto the bus. We were put into the second-to-last compartment, and I was seated against the barred window in the forward-facing bench. The deputy checked us, closed the gate, and locked it, and proceeded to fill the next compartment. I leaned forward to look across the man next to me to the prisoner seated on my row against the opposite window. I recognized him, but not from the keep-away module. I couldn't place him. It could have been from court or a potential client meeting in which I didn't take the case. He was checking me out as I was checking him, and that fired my paranoia. I knew I had to keep a watch on him. The bus exited the garage beneath the courts building and trundled up the steep grade to Spring Street. As it turned left, City Hall was on the right side, and several prisoners followed the tradition of flipping the finger at the seat of power.
This, of course, could not be seen by anyone on the marble steps or behind the windows of the iconic building. The bus's windows were actually slotted metal that allowed a confined view out, but no view in. I watched the man I was curious about hold his hand up and extend the fuck you finger. He did it so routinely, without even looking out through the slots himself, that I knew he was a regular guest of the system. And that was when I recognized him. He was the client of a colleague whom I had once filled in for during a hearing before a judge. It had been a babysitting job, a minor hearing that involved a court appearance. Dan Daly had been stuck in a trial and asked me to handle it, and I did. Satisfied that I had answered the question and that the man posed no special threat, I relaxed and leaned back in my seat, tilting my head up to look at the ceiling. I started counting the days until the start of my trial and how soon I could reasonably expect to walk free after a not guilty verdict. It was the last thing I remembered. Chapter 36. Thursday, February 6th. I could only open my eyes to narrow slices of light. It wasn't the harshness of the light that prevented me from opening them wider. It was physical impediment. I simply could not do it. I was disoriented at first, not sure where I was. Mickey? I turned at the voice, recognized it. Jennifer? The one word set fire to my throat, the pain so sharp I grimaced. Yes, I'm here. How do you feel? I can't see. What? Your eyes are swollen. You burst a lot of blood vessels. I burst blood vessels? This didn't make sense. What do you mean? I asked. How did I... Oh, it hurts to talk. Don't talk, Jennifer said. Just listen. We went over this an hour ago, and then the sedation hit and you went out again. You were attacked, Mickey, on the jail bus after court yesterday. Yesterday? Don't talk. Yes, you've lost a day. But if you can stay awake, I can get them in here to do the testing. They need to check your brain function to see if there was anything, so we'll know if there is anything permanent. What happened on the bus? The pain. I don't know all the details, and the sheriff's investigator wants to talk to you about it. He's waiting outside, but I told him I was going to talk to you first. Basically, another man on the bus got his chain free and used it to choke you. He was behind you and wrapped it around your neck. They thought you were dead, but paramedics revived you, Mickey. They say it's a miracle you're alive. It doesn't feel like a miracle. Where am I? I was beginning to be able to manage the pain. Talking in a monotone, turning my head slightly to the left seemed to lessen it. County USC, the jail ward. Haley and Lorna and everybody wanted to come in to see you, but you're on lockdown, and they'd only let me in. I don't think you'd want them seeing you like this anyway. Better to wait till the swelling goes down. I felt her hand grip my shoulder. Are we alone in here? I asked. Yes, Jennifer said. This is an attorney-client meeting. There's a deputy outside the door, but it's closed. Also, the investigator's out there, waiting to talk to you. Okay, listen. Don't let them use this to delay the trial. Well, we'll see, Mickey. You need to be tested to make sure you... No, I'm fine. I can tell. I'm already thinking about the case, and I don't want to delay it. We have them where we want them, and I don't want to give them time to catch up to us. That's it. Okay, I'll object if they try. Who was the guy? What guy? The one who choked me with the chain. I don't know. I only got his name, Mason Maddox. Lorna put it through the Conflict of Interest app, and there were no hits. You have no prior history with him. He was convicted last month of 3 murders. I haven't gotten the case details yet. He was in court for a motions hearing. Who's his lawyer? The PD.
I don't have that information yet.
Why'd he do it? Who put him up to it?
If the sheriff's department knows, they're not sharing it with me. I have Cisco looking into it, and a call in to Harry Bosch.
I don't want to pull Cisco off trial prep. That could be the whole motive behind it.
No, because he tried to kill you and probably thought he did. You don't kill a guy to distract his investigators. I filed a motion with Warfield today, asking her to issue an order reinstituting bail or ordering the sheriff to transport you by car to and from court. No more buses. Too dangerous.
That's good thinking.
I hope to get a hearing on it this afternoon. We'll see.
Is there, like, a hand mirror around here or something?
Why?
I want to see myself.
Mickey, I don't think you...
It's all right. I just want to take a quick look, and I'll be fine.
I don't see a mirror, but hold on. I have something.
I heard her unzip her purse, and then she put a small square object in my hand, a mirror from a makeup case. I held it up to my face and managed to get a glimpse. I look like a boxer on the morning after a fight, and a losing bout at that. My eyes were swollen, and the rash of exploded blood vessels extended from the corners of my eyes and across both cheeks.
Jesus, I said.
Yeah, not a good look,
Jennifer said.
I still think you should let the doctor test you.
I'm going to be fine.
Mickey, there could be something, and you should know.
But then the prosecution could know, and they'll use it to ask for a delay.
There was a brief silence, as Jennifer considered that and realized I was right.
Okay, I'm getting tired, I said. Send in the investigator. Let's see what he says.
Are you sure?
She asked. Yes, and don't pull Cisco off trial prep. When you hear from Bosch, put him on Mason Maddox. I want to know everything. There's got to be a link somewhere.
A link to what, Mickey?
A link to the case. Or the sheriff's wiretap investigation. Something. We have to look at everybody. The sheriffs, Aparicio, the FBI, everybody.
Okay, I'll tell the guys.
You think I'm paranoid, don't you?
I just think it's kind of far-fetched.
I nodded. Maybe it was.
Did they let you bring your phone in here? I asked.
Yes,
she said.
Okay, take a picture of me. You might want to show it to the judge when you make your argument for protection.
Good idea.
I heard her getting her phone out of her purse.
I'm sure Berg will object to it, she said, but worth a try.
If the judge knows there's a photo, she'll want to see it, I said. Human curiosity. I heard her snap the shot.
Okay, Mickey, she said. Rest up.
That's the plan, I said.
I heard her step toward the door.
Jennifer, I said.
I heard her steps come back to the bed.
Yes, I'm here, Jennifer said.
Look, I can't really see yet, but I can hear, I said.
Okay.
And I hear doubt in your voice.
No, you're wrong.
Look, it's a natural thing to question things. I think you...
It's not that, Mickey.
Then what is it?
Okay, look. It's my father. He's gotten sick. I'm worried about him.
Is he in the hospital? What's wrong?
That's the thing. We're not getting straight answers. He's in a care home up in Seattle, and my sister and I are not getting answers.
Is your sister there?
Yes, she thinks I should go up, if I want to see him before, you know.
Then she's right. You need to go.
But we have the case, the trial. The motions hearing is next week, and now this attack.
I knew that losing her could be devastating to the case, but there was no choice. Look, I said, you gotta go. You can take your laptop, and there's a lot you can do from up there when you're not with your father. You can write motions. Cisco can get them to the court clerk.
It's not the same, she said.
I know it's not, but it's what we can do. You need to go.
I feel like I'm leaving you all alone. I'll figure something out. Go up there, see him, and who knows, maybe he'll start feeling better and you can get back down for trial. She didn't respond at first. I had said my piece and was already thinking of alternative ways to go. I'm going to think about it tonight, Jennifer finally said. I'll let you know tomorrow, okay? That's okay, but I don't think there's much to think about. It's family, your father. You have to go. Thanks, Mickey. I nodded. I heard her steps again as she headed to the door. I tried to relax my throat and ease the pain. Talking felt like swallowing glass. Then I heard Jennifer tell the investigator waiting outside the room that he could go in. Part 4. Bleeding the Beast. Chapter 37. Wednesday, February 19th. The world seemed to be on the edge of chaos. More than 1,000 people were dead from a mystery virus in China. Almost 1 billion people were on lockdown there, and American citizens had been evacuated. There were cruise ships out on the Pacific that were floating incubators of the virus, and no vaccine was on the horizon. The president was saying the crisis would pass, while his own virus expert was saying brace for a pandemic. Closer to home, Jennifer Aronson's father had just died in Seattle of an undiagnosed illness, and she was not getting any answers. In L.A., it was the second day of jury selection in the trial of my life. We had been proceeding at a rapid pace. The 4 days scheduled for voir dire had been cut in half by a judge who also felt that there was a coming wave. She wanted this trial over with before the wave hit, and while I wasn't comfortable hurrying to pick a jury, I was right there with the judge. I wanted this over. Some of the deputies at Twin Towers had started wearing masks, and I took that as a sign. I didn't want to be in lockup when that wave the judge was worried about came in. Still, picking the 12 strangers who would deliberate the case involved the most important decisions of the trial. Those 12 would hold my life in their hands, and the time allotted to choosing them had been chopped in half. This had caused me to take extraordinary measures to quickly try to find out who these people were. Jury selection was an art form. It involved research, knowledge of social and cultural data, and finally, gut instinct. What you want in the end is a panel of attentive people who are there for the truth. What you look for and hope to root out are those who view the truth through the prism of bias, racial, political, cultural, and so forth, and those with ulterior motives for serving. The process begins with the judge weeding out jurors who have conflicts of schedule, can't sit in judgment of others, or can't grasp the meaning of legal tenets, like reasonable doubt. It then moves to the lawyers, who may question jurors further to determine if they should be dismissed for cause, reasons of bias, or background. The prosecution and defense are also given an equal number of peremptory challenges, allowing them to dismiss jurors for unstated reasons. And that is where gut instinct most often comes into play. All of this must be synthesized into decisions about whom to keep in and whom to kick out. That is the art, to finally arrive at a panel of 12 people you believe will be open to your cause. I fully admit that there is an advantage to the defense in that it has to win the belief of only one juror to be successful, one doubter of the state's case. One holdout for the defense can hang a jury and force the state to start over, or even reconsider whether to go forward with a second trial at all. The state must win all 12 hearts and minds to get a conviction. Still, the state's advantages beyond this one are so enormous as to make the defense's jury advantage negligible. But you take what you are given, and therefore, jury selection has always been sacred to me. made all the more so this time because I was the defendant. It was 2 p.m., and the judge was expecting, no, demanding, that a jury be impaneled by the close of court in 3 hours. I could push it into the next day because the judge ultimately wouldn't want to enforce a demand that was potentially reversible on appeal. But if I did force the issue, there would be consequences down the line in terms of rulings from the bench. Besides that, I was down to my last peremptory challenge, and I knew there was no way I would be able to milk it for 3 more hours. We would fill the box before the courtroom went dark, and the prosecution in the murder of Sam Scales would begin in the morning. The good news was, the panel was largely set with jurors who I believed ranged on the defense meter from yellow, the middle ground, to deep green for pro-defense. Because of long-embedded and rightful distrust of police in minority communities, black and brown jurors were always prized by the defense because they tended to view the testimony of police officers with suspicion. I had managed to keep 4 African Americans and 2 Latinas on the panel, fending off Dana Berg's efforts to jettison the blacks in particular. When one black panelist revealed under questioning that she had once made a donation to the local Black Lives Matter organization, Berg first asked for the woman to be dismissed for cause. Making the request to an African-American judge took a certain level of courage, but it also underlined Berg's singular purpose in convicting me. When the judge denied the motion, the prosecutor then attempted to use a peremptory challenge. That was when I swung in with an objection that the move was based on race, a clear exception to the rules of peremptory challenges. The judge agreed, and the juror was seated. The ruling put Berg on notice in regard to future efforts to scalp the jury along racial lines, but then allowed me to do just that. It was a big win for the defense, but the last round of challenges had left 3 new faces in the box, and I had just 1 peremptory. All 3 were white, 2 women and 1 man. And this was where my extraordinary juror profiling came into play. Early the morning before, Cisco had posted himself in the First Street garage, where jurors were directed to park. At that point, a few hundred potential jurors had been summoned for jury duty. Cisco had no way of knowing who would end up on my panel, but he took note of character-defining aspects of the people arriving. Things like make and model of cars, registrations, bumper stickers, interior contents, and so on. A person driving a Mercedes SL is going to have a different worldview from someone driving a Toyota Prius. Sometimes you want the Mercedes on the jury, sometimes you want the Prius. After the first morning session with the 100 people called for the panel in my case, Cisco went back to the garage at lunchtime and then again at the end of the day. By his 4th time in the garage on Wednesday morning, he was recognizing people assigned to my case and building intel on many of them. When court was back in session, he returned from the garage, sat in the gallery, and communicated what he knew about each potential juror to my co-counsel. I wasn't alone at the table, but I wasn't with Jennifer Aronson either. My new co-counsel was Maggie McPherson. She had taken a leave of absence from the district attorney's office and answered my distress call. I could think of no one better to be sitting next to as I faced the most difficult challenge of my life. You never want to use your last peremptory because you never know who will take the seat of the potential juror you just dismissed. You could clear the way for a new face that is a prosecutor's dream, and you are left with nothing with which to stop it. So you always hold back the last peremptory for emergency circumstances only. I learned this the hard way as a baby lawyer when I was defending a man accused of assaulting a police officer and resisting arrest. I felt sure that the assault charge was bogus, an add-on by the arresting officer because of personal animosity. The officer was white and my client black. During jury selection, I gambled with my last peremptory to kick out a potential juror who was yellow on my meter. There were still several African Americans in the courtroom pool, waiting to be randomly called to the box.
I figured my chances were almost 50-50 that one of them would get the call to take the open seat for questioning. The move paid off. A black woman was called, but under questioning, she revealed that she was the daughter of a retired law enforcement officer who had served in the sheriff's department for 32 years. I questioned her at length, trying to elicit an answer that would get her bumped off for cause, but she maintained her stance that she could view the case impartially. The judge denied my request to dismiss her, so there I was, with a cop's daughter on my assault on a police officer jury, and no peremptory to change it. My client went down on all charges and spent a year in a county detention center for a crime I believed he had not committed. I followed my usual routine for charting and tracking jurors through the selection process. A plain manila file folder was open flat on the defense table. I had drawn what I called the ice cube tray across both flaps, a long rectangle divided into 14 squares for the jury of 12 and two alternates. Each cube was 2 inches square, the size of a small post-it note. I wrote the salient thoughts and details about each prospective juror in the cube, numbered for the jury box seat the candidate occupied. As jurors were dismissed and new people took the seats, I used post-its to cover the no longer needed details and start again. Charting everything on the file folder allowed me to flip it closed if inquiring eyes wandered over from the prosecution table. The prosecution got to question the new additions to the panel first, and while Berg went through her routine questions, Maggie and I checked the texts coming to her laptop from Cisco, who had to disguise what he was doing, because no one but the attorneys on the case was allowed to use electronic devices in the courtroom. Cisco hid his phone from the courtroom deputies by keeping it down on the bench next to one of his massive thighs. To protect the anonymity of the jury in a criminal case, the prospective jurors were referred to by numbers given to them when they checked in at the jury coordination center on the first floor. Cisco's texts did the same. 17, parked in handicap, no tag. That reference was to the male member of the new trio. It was an interesting piece of information, but not something I would be able to go at directly without possibly giving away how I got the information. Revealing that I had an investigator scoping out potential jurors in the parking garage would not go over well with the judge or the California bar. It didn't go over well with Maggie McPherce either. She was getting a quick education in criminal defense and didn't always like what she was learning. But I wasn't worried. She was now co-opted by the attorney-client relationship. I had watched number 17 stand up in the gallery when his number was called. He had squeezed past others out of the row and then moved to the jury box for questioning without showing any obvious physical difficulty or handicap. Of course, there were other possible unseen issues that could have resulted in his receiving a handicap tag. But it bothered me. If the man was a cheat, I didn't want him on the jury. Cisco immediately followed his first missive with a text on one of the women. 68 should be 86th. Trump 2020 bumper sticker. This was good intel. Politics were a good window into a person's soul. If 68 was a supporter of the president, it was likely she was a law and order hardliner. Not good for a guy accused of murder. That this person would continue to support the president after the media had documented his many, many untruths was a factor as well. It was blind loyalty to a cause and an indicator that truthfulness was not an important part of her framework. I agreed with Cisco. She had to go. On the third potential juror, number 21, Cisco had limited intel. 21 drives a Prius. Extinction Rebellion sticker on rear window. I didn't know what an Extinction Rebellion sign was, but I thought I understood the sticker's message. Both pieces of information were almost useless. Both could be indicators of judgmental personality, particularly when it came to the environment and crime. I drove a gas-eating Lincoln, and that would certainly come out in trial. and I was charged with a very violent crime while being a person who associated professionally with others charged with violent acts. I kept an ear on the proceedings as Berg questioned the new candidates, but I also huddled with Maggie as she pulled out the questionnaires the three had filled out when reporting for jury service. Immediately, I changed my mind about 21. I liked what I read. She was 36 years old, unmarried, lived in Studio City, and had a job as a prep chef at one of the upscale restaurants at the Hollywood Bowl. This told me she liked music and culture and chose to work in a place that had both. She also listed reading first among her hobbies. I didn't think anyone who is a reader could avoid coming across stories, nonfiction or fiction, that underscored the frailties of the American justice system, chief among them that the police don't always get it right, and that innocent people are sometimes accused and convicted of crimes they didn't commit. I believe that would give 21 an open mind. She would listen closely to my case.
"I want her," I whispered.
"Yeah, she looks good," Maggie whispered back.
I moved on to the other two questionnaires. I saw that 68, the other female, was my age and had gotten married the same year she graduated from Pepperdine, a conservative Christian school in Malibu. Add all of that to the Trump bumper sticker, and I was convinced she had to go. Maggie agreed.
"You want to use the last challenge?" she asked.
"No, I'm going to question her," I said. "Try to get her bumped for cause."
"What about the guy? There's nothing here."
She was referring to 17.
I scanned his questionnaire and had to agree with Maggie.
Nothing on the single page drew a flag. He was 46 years old and married, an assistant principal at a private school in Encino. I was familiar with it because Maggie and I had flirted with the idea of sending Haley there for elementary school many years before. We took the tour and went to a parent's presentation, but ultimately got a bad vibe. Most of the students came from well-to-do families. We weren't destitute by any means, but Maggie was a civil servant and I was always chasing money cases. Some years were fat, some were thin. We thought the peer pressure on our daughter would be unhealthy. We enrolled her somewhere else.
"You remember this guy?" I asked. "He would have been there when we looked at the place."
"I don't recognize him," Maggie said. "I'll see what I can get on Q&A.
You okay with my taking all three?"
"Of course, it's your case. I don't want you deferring to me."
While Berg finished her canvassing of the jurors, I wrote notes on all three on post-its and attached them to the corresponding squares on my ice cube tray chart. I wrote in green for 21 and red for 68. For 17, I wrote a yellow question mark. Then I folded the file closed.
Chapter 38.
When it was my turn to question the people who might decide my future, the judge verbally cut me off at the knees before I even got to the lectern. "You have 15 minutes, Mr. Holler," she said.
"Your Honor, we technically have three open seats and then the alternates to fill," I protested. "The prosecution just took way more than 15 minutes to question these three."
"No, you're wrong. I timed it. 14 minutes. I'm giving you 15, starting now. You can use the time to argue with me or to question the jurors."
"Thank you, Your Honor."
I went to the lectern and started with number 68. "Juror 68, I was looking at your questionnaire and didn't see what your husband does for a living."
"My husband was killed in Iraq 17 years ago."
That brought a moment of silence, a collective holding of breath as I retooled my approach. I could not let the jurors who were already seated see me treat the woman with anything but kid gloves.
"I'm sorry for your loss," I said, and that I even brought the memory up.
"Don't worry," she said. "The memory never goes away."
I nodded. Though I had stumbled into this, I had to find a way to finesse my way out.
On the questionnaire, you didn't check that you had been a victim of a crime. Don't you consider the loss of your husband to be, in a way, a crime?"
That was war. That was different. He gave his life for his country.
God and country. A defense lawyer's nightmare on a jury.
Then he was a hero, I offered.
And still is, she said.
Right, he still is.
Thank you.
Have you been on a jury before, ma'am?
It was one of the questions on the form.
No, I have not. And please don't call me ma'am. Makes me feel like my mother.
There was a slight tickle of laughter in the courtroom. I smiled and pressed on.
I will refrain from doing that. Let me ask you a question. If a police officer testifies to one thing, and then a regular citizen testifies and says the opposite, whom do you believe?
Well, I guess you just have to weigh what each one says and try to figure out who's telling the truth. It could be the officer, but it might not be.
But do you give the police officer the benefit of the doubt?
Not necessarily. I would have to hear more about the officer. You know, who he is, how he comes across, like that.
I nodded. It was becoming clear that she was a jury duty. Someone who wants to be on the jury and gives the right answers to every question, whether or not it reflects her true sentiments. I am always suspicious of people who want to be on a jury, who want to judge others.
Okay, and as the judge explained yesterday, you know that I am both the defendant and defense attorney in this case. If at the end of this trial you think that I probably committed the crime of murder, how do you vote in the jury room?
I would have to trust my instincts after weighing the evidence.
Which means what? How would you vote?
If I'm convinced beyond a reasonable doubt, I vote guilty.
Is thinking I probably did it convincing? Is that what you mean?
No, like I said, I would have to feel you are guilty beyond a reasonable doubt.
What does reasonable doubt mean to you, ma'am?
Before 68 could answer, the judge cut in.
Mr. Holler, are you trying to bait the juror? Warfield said. She asked you not to call her that.
No, Judge, I said. I just forgot. My southern manners. I apologize.
That's all well and good, but I know you were born right here in Los Angeles because I knew your father.
Just a figure of speech, Your Honor. I won't say the offending word again.
Very well, continue.
You're using up all your time on this one juror. I'm not giving you an extension.
15 minutes to interview the people who might decide your fate. I thought I had my first point of appeal should the trial not go the way I wanted it to. I turned my attention back to the woman in the jury box.
If you could, can you tell us what you believe reasonable doubt to mean?
Just that there's no other possible explanation. Based on the evidence and your evaluation of it, it couldn't have been anybody else.
I realized I wasn't going to be able to make any headway with her. She had her answers rehearsed. I had to wonder whether she had been following the case in the media.
Yesterday morning, the judge asked for a show of hands for anyone who had read about this case in the media. You did not raise your hand, correct?
That's correct. I had never heard of it before.
I didn't believe her. She knew about the case, and for some reason wanted to be on the jury. I checked my watch and moved on to Mr. 17. I had no choice.
Sir, you are an assistant principal at a private elementary school, correct?
Yes, that's right.
I see on the questionnaire that you have a master's degree in education and are working on a doctorate.
Yes, part-time on the doctorate.
Is there a reason why you haven't chosen to teach at the university level?
Not really. I like working with younger kids. That's where I get my fulfillment.
I nodded.
It says you also coach the boys' basketball team at the school. Does that require a lot of physical activity on your part?
Well, I think the boys should see their coach as someone who can keep up with them, someone in shape.
You do strength training exercises with them?
Sometimes.
You run with them?
I do laps in the gym with them.
What is your philosophy on sport? Winning is everything?
Well, I'm competitive, yes, but I don't think winning is everything.
What do you think, then?
I think winning is better than losing.
That drew some polite laughter, and I changed the direction of my questions.
Your wife. According to the info sheet, she is a teacher as well?
Yes, same school. We met there.
So I assume you carpool to school together?
No, I have the coaching after school, and she has a part-time job at a craft store, so different schedules, different cars.
Do you think that there are serious crimes and not serious crimes?
Excuse me?
Do you think that there are some crimes that shouldn't be considered crimes?
I don't really understand.
I guess I'm talking about the highs and lows. Murder, that's a crime, right?
Yes, of course.
And those who murder should pay for their crimes, you agree?
Of course.
What about smaller crimes, crimes where there are no victims? Should we bother with those?
A crime is a crime.
The judge intervened again. Mr. Haller, do you intend to question Juror 21 with the time you have left? She asked. I was annoyed at the interruption. I was building toward a decision with 17, and she shouldn't have interrupted. As soon as I'm finished here, Your Honor, I said, my frustration clear in my voice, can I proceed?
Go ahead, Warfield said.
Thank you.
You're welcome, Mr. Haller.
I turned back to 17 and attempted to gather my splintered momentum. Sir, is a crime, no matter how big or small?
Yes, of course.
What about jaywalking? It's against the law, but do you think it's a crime?
Well, if that's what the law is, then yes, I guess it's a crime. A minor crime.
What about parking in a handicap zone when you have no handicap?
It was a gamble. All I knew about 17 was what I had read on the questionnaire and what I learned in the text from Cisco about his parking in a handicap spot. I had to make a call on him, but could only dance around the essential question. Was he a cheater? We stared at each other in silent communication before 17 finally spoke.
There might be a reasonable explanation for someone doing that, he said.
There was. He didn't believe he needed to play by the rules. He was a cheater, and he had to go.
So what you're saying is that... Warfield interrupted again.
Your time is up, Mr. Haller, she said. Counsel, approach.
I cursed under my breath and turned away from 17. We had been handling challenges at the bench so the objections to jurors, possibly embarrassing to them, were not made in open court. But when I got to the bench, I was too hot to worry about keeping my voice down.
Your Honor, I need time to question the last juror, I said. You can't arbitrarily set my time based on what time the state needed. That is patently unfair to the defense.
Maggie had joined the conference at the bench. She now lightly touched my arm as the judge responded. It was a warning to tread carefully.
Mr. Haller,